you're not good with money is not true. You are actually good with money. The problem is you're operating in quite a difficult situation. You might not have the education. There might be influences in your nervous system that are meaning things are difficult because of past experience around money and other traumas.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Harriet Formby from Below the Line Finance, and we are going to have an animated discussion about this book here, a book that I love, me and my wife actually love. We found it a while ago, and having run businesses for many years, bereft of any profit, I'll be honest, I was thinking like, oh, that's the book I need. It's called Profit First. It's written by an American author, Mike Michalowicz. I should have practiced that. So sorry, Mike, for mangling your name there. But this book is very popular amongst entrepreneurs, but we're going to talk about some reasons why maybe entrepreneurs should think twice before they run off and implement something. And Harriet has some opinions on this. So Harriet, just before we get into that, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe tell us a little bit about you and your background and where you are sitting in the world today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a fractional CFO and business mentor. So I work with business owners, startups, SMEs, and my real thing is supporting people that are sort of changing the world for the better. So I help them to create the financial systems and structures that are going to not only feel good, but also do good things for them as well. And it's all about kind of impact, mission, and that sort of thing. So I am based in the southwest in the UK. I'm pretty rural, and I have a kind of off-grid office location. Very much somebody who's transitioned from, you know, working in the corporate world, commuting cities, to I guess defining things how it kind of suits me for this stage of life, and yeah, really enjoying the kind of the good balance that you get from that.
Yeah, so super popular trend, people moving away from corporate, bringing that expertise into the real world, as I would call it. That's interesting. So you're called Below the Line. When you decided to set up your business, you decided to call Below the Line Finance. What's with the name?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually, and one that I do get asked occasionally. So the idea, and it very much came to me before, you know, I guess to set up the company, I was like, I need a website, so I need a name, I need a domain. So that was the kind of first pressure. And there was two things going on at the time that coincided really beautifully, which was firstly that I was just playing around with the name. In the world I was with finance, we always talked about above the line and below the line expenses, and it was always to do with profits. And actually, I was really interested in that terminology about who was benefiting from those profits, what they really meant in real life, and having that kind of debate around it. And at the same time, I actually, when I sort of transitioned out of the corporate world, I bought a 15-acre site, which had turned into like a small holding and really lovely nature and all that sort of thing. And that, by coincidence, was just below a railway line, an old railway line. And the field was called, or is called, Below the Line. So I thought, actually, this is really symbolic to my transition. It gives a nod to the idea that I want profits to be something that's, you know, positive and it's real world. And so, yeah, Below the Line Finance came into existence.
I love it. I think it's fantastic. I love the way I was expecting some very technical explanation, and the fact that you're below a train line, that's like perfect. It's the perfect, what do you call it? It's like it's a diversion, if you like. So it works perfectly well. Very good. Okay, so let's get stuck into this book here. So Profit First, I suspect a lot of people have heard of it. I know amongst my entrepreneur friends, it's been very popular. And maybe how did you first come across it? Have you noticed has been reading this book?
I just heard a lot of buzz around it. Yeah, I guess the last couple of years, and particularly sort of the States, a lot of talk in those circles. And then I started to come across actually, you know, real life business owners using the methods and potentially, you know, having good results, and also in the context of sort of my work where they were kind of saying, look, we've actually got a problem. with our profit, we can't figure out why we're not making profit. And the really interesting point was they were often saying, we use profits first. We've got the bank account set up, but for some reason, there's no money in all those bank pots that we've created. And we thought we were doing it right. And we can't figure out why we don't have any money. So that's, I guess, where it's kind of come from. And then I, you know, myself, part of my reason, I suppose, for the transition to working in the way that kind of I felt was more suitable for modern businesses was that I was seeing this, you know, corporate structure where we always talk about, look, it's sales. We focus on the sales. We sort the costs out. If you're the business owner, you get what's left at the bottom. We don't really think any more than that. And I was also experimenting with flipping this around to start with, why are you in business and what do you want financially to do with these profits? Because you might want to have a really good quality of life and be able to invest and have security. You might want to reinvest them in things like community projects and really great things, or in obviously development of your business. Or you might be looking to, you know, create profits so you can sell the business and show that you've got really great profits. And that's maybe your exit strategy.
Okay, great. So tell me, let's start off with what's the headline advice that is in this book for anyone who hasn't read it? And then we'll get on to the good and the bad.
Yeah, so good question. So it's basically flipping it around to say, you know, the thing I really agree with, we shouldn't go with the traditional accounting formula of revenue minus expenses equals profits. You get what's left over at the end. It's very much that the way they do the formula is it's revenue minus profits. So you take the profit out first and then you're left with, you know, the other balancing side is the expenses. So what this is actually saying is, you know, practical end of it is when a client pays you a chunk of money, you would take that money and you would say, look, 20% goes to tax, 10% goes here, 10%, you know, and you would allocate where that profit is going into a range of bank accounts. So profit, owner's pay, taxes, operating expenses are the traditional ones that they sort of recommend on a basis of percentages. And those can vary by industry, or I think they've got some standard ones. And basically what it's doing is creating a disciplined approach to say, actually, you know, the money that comes into your bank account isn't just yours to go and spend. You've got to pay your taxes. You've got to pay your bills. You've got to pay yourself, you know, in the future. And so it's giving you some discipline to realize this. And iteratively, I guess you go back and say, okay, well, I need to charge a bit more because I also need to pay tax and I need to pay this, that, and the other. And it's a way of, yeah, visually, you know, it's great because you can look in your bank accounts and, you know, get them up on online banking, see them all there and go, brilliant, I've got all the things I need where I need them. I can pay my staff, I can pay my tax, all brilliant. And if you've got a business that, you know, runs like that, you've got some autonomy about how you charge, what you're selling, how you're doing things, and you're not too reliant on lots of overheads and things, then, yeah, it can be pretty good.
Okay, so the attraction and, you know, from a sophisticated finance professional like yourself, it must seem almost like caveman stuff. So he recommends setting up a literal business account where you literally put that percentage of cash that comes in and you put it in there and you can kind of see it, which the visceral part of that I totally get as a like, because it's so easy to run around and fool yourself that you're doing things which are growing a business. And we all start a business with a view of having, you know, the business working for you instead of you working for the business. But a lot of people never got there. And this idea of viscerally being able to see profits grow physically somewhere you can stick an ATM card into is very attractive. So I can see why that's attractive. But what do people get wrong when it comes to when they read the book? I can see the attraction, but what's your criticism of, or what you need to think about before you run off and do this?
I think it sets an expectation that so long as you follow the process, your profits will naturally, you know, drop out and things will all work well. And almost like if it doesn't happen, maybe you're doing something wrong, which isn't necessarily the case, right? I don't think so. I think it kind of goes, I think that the message I would say is actually it's an amazing starting point to get into the kind of financial literacy of business, into having discipline, starting to understand the interplay between profit and cash flow. But then there is so, and my argument would be there's so much more to actually profit than just almost like allocating cash, and there's so much more nuance to it that if you, yeah, you can get quite almost stuck. So if we were to look at some examples, so if you say, for example, if you are under, so you can say somebody's underpricing, that is the thing, not charging enough sounds like, oh, well, that's simple, just put your prices up, you know, why aren't they charging more, why, and the equation will work. But sometimes people don't know that they're undercharging. So, for example, you could be a business that has contracts or projects you're working on, and you have worked out your pricing, and you think you've sorted this out. You think there's enough profit there. You think you've got your costs covered. But actually, you go ahead and you do all the things, and then actually, you move on to the next project. But when you come back, you realize, you know, if you come back, or if we probe, or if we just say, hang on a minute, what happened there? You realize that what you thought you were doing wasn't what you were doing. Your resource allocation was a lot more. Therefore, there was less profit to actually put back into the pot. And this can be as simple as, you know, timesheets. So knowing who's working on what, when, how much time you're actually spending on things. And particularly as a business owner, the one thing that's quite game-changing is if you realize that you need to, you know, if you are part of the revenue-generating side, that, you know, you're not just standing on the sidelines doing the strategy, you need to price yourself into that as well. You need to have an allocation of your time in there as well. And this is something that I've seen, you know, particularly with elements where there's an element of manufacturing, there's a physical product, you know, an example, shuttering, you know, fixings for, you know, industrial buildings, that sort of thing, where actually what you think you're charging and you're going out and quoting for, you're not necessarily. And sometimes it's a case of realizing that, for example, if you are going out and doing quotes, that needs to be covered in the profits that you make from all the work you win. You need to factor in the time and maybe, you know, travel costs of going to sites. You've got to recover that somewhere. And that's hidden because you think, oh, that's just me, you know, trying to find work, marketing, doing the new business stuff. But actually, that's going to go into the profit mix as well. And that could be, you know, we could be talking about smaller businesses where it's just you as the, you know, going around doing it. But there might well be a team or some individuals or, you know, a number of people whose job that is. Actually, that's got to go into the mix as well. And sometimes people forget that when you are going, okay, this is the price of an average kind of job we do, actually, you're forgetting that there's admin involved with going back and forward, with billing them, with all these other things. And actually, you know, I can look at it and say, you just need to charge more. But that doesn't go down very well because people kind of don't know if the market will take it. They're not uneasy about it. But if you say, actually, let's go through it. Let's, you know, I've done this with people where we sit down and say, what's the most common thing that you offer? Let's just go from start to finish. An example, even if it's, we have to do it live and do the next one that comes along, and we just dissect how long it took, what was involved, all the steps, and actually what's the profit contribution on that? Because in the long run, you're only going to have these profits if you can actually make that work.
Yeah. I mean, I can see immediately as someone who works in finance, working from the line items up, let's call it, you know, this approach is controversial because it takes a far fuzzier view of it. It's kind of saying, well, your marketing is probably 20%, your sales commission is probably 10%, your overhead is probably 20%. And then it kind of encourages you to take that money out based on very broad attributes, which, you know, which may be fine when you only have only one product. But as soon as you have two products, suddenly that goes out the window because you're not really sure, you know, exactly how much each product is contributing to that. So it might be too simplistic. And I can see how, you know, I guess pricing is my favorite topic. I think almost everyone, if you want to increase your price, you just have to demonstrate the value. And sometimes you're lazy and you don't want to demonstrate the value. So you just keep your prices low, right? But actually learning how to demonstrate value is actually might be what you need to do in order for your business to grow. Mm. So what about moving on to pricing? I get that, you know, you might need to put prices up. That might not be a popular thing to have to tell your sales team or maybe an owner manager who finds it hard enough to sell as it is. What about payment terms? How does that work with the profit first methodology? Because you mentioned projects there. It's straightforward if I'm selling things over the counter in a shop, maybe. I don't know, maybe it's not. But like when I get into projects, then the payments can get a lot fuzzier. How do people approach that, or what are the mistakes you've seen?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So on payment terms, the one thing that I often see is people are really generous. They want to give credit. They want to, they almost feel obliged to actually, I don't want to take the money up front if the project is still ongoing. I want to deliver the project, take a little deposit, take a bit on the way. And then do you know what? They can pay me a huge chunk at the end. It's absolutely fine with me. The problem with that is you've probably, you know, paid for resources, maybe, you know, other consultants, freelancers, material costs, bills, you know, deal with a lot of people in the events industry. There's a lot of things involved in supporting the events industry. And actually, if you rely on leaving it, you know, a huge chunk, maybe, you know, 25% is still, that could be your chunk of profit that you're leaving till right at the end. Now, if you go and look in your bank account, you are going to see an issue that you maybe can't pay yourself or you can't do what you want to do because all the costs have already gone out for that project. And this little bit of profit that you're going to get at the end, you're waiting, you know, till right at the end. And if you're working with a big organization, you might be waiting 3 months to get paid. And suddenly you've got
I had to smile there, Harry, because your clients are obviously way nicer than I am because I'm not generous with my payment terms. I'm like, no, I like getting paid up front for my service. Thanks very much. That's kind of my take on it. And I see, but I can see how there's that pressure. Like oftentimes people are on the interface between sales and the customer and finance. And you just want to, obviously you wouldn't be in business if you weren't delivering value. And part of that is just trying to be nice, but that can be a lot more difficult, especially with these project-based where let's say you're running an event, you think you've made the fat lady has sung, all the lights are over, you've done the cleanup, you think you made a profit and then bang, invoices start hitting you. 3 months later, you weren't expecting that event that you thought you were running, thought it was a profit. You've already taken the profit, put it in your nice, tidy little profit account and maybe, you know, given your family a nice night out with it. Whereas, no, that those invoices were always coming. You just forgot to take account for them. And that was then suddenly then fat lady does start crying, I guess, or singing. So I get that. Payment terms, it just makes this profit thing not as straightforward. What about other hidden operational inefficiencies you see that you can murky the waters when it comes to this method of running your business?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is down to, you know, and the, obviously the counter for this is to really regularly review the success of, you know, your manufacturing costs and processes, or if it's more service-based, what's actually happening. And sometimes I think something you mentioned actually about, you know, pricing and things is actually what people don't realize if they're just head down in their own, you know, empire and world of business. They think what they're doing is just very mundane, but actually what they're doing, and you know, most businesses, we can't be the cheapest because we're not Amazon. You know, we can't always be the cheapest. We have to be the best at what we deliver, and we have to have good service quality. And actually that's the only way that you can make good profits for most businesses is actually to, you know, actually value your operating, your way you're doing things, and actually take pride in being really efficient and having really good, you know, customer interactions, and, you know, being quite ruthless about who you maybe want as customers as well, because that can help, you know, if you're finding that actually the complaints team are dealing with, you know, 20% of your clients or something, then maybe you've got an issue you need to go and have a look at, and you could, you know, strip out a load of cost by simply going and sorting that problem. Or maybe there wasn't a good alignment with those customers. A really good one that is very much for kind of like site-based businesses is, you know, you do your marketing budget and you just kind of chuck it out to anybody. And actually you're site-based, so what you'd really love to see is, you know, you're going out in vans to deliver product to industrial estates, for example, you actually need to be able to be efficient and say, okay, well, wouldn't it be great if we had another 20 clients on this, you know, great big industrial unit site? Let's target our marketing and make sure we get a few more here, because then when our drivers come out, they're actually, you know, using the best use of their time and efficiencies. So it can actually be, you know, it doesn't mean always cutting costs and making people redundant and stretching, as it can actually be taking pride in being efficient, doing a good service, and really knowing who your clients are. The other side to that, I think, is, you know, sometimes we've got to acknowledge that perhaps we don't always have the autonomy over our costs in the way that we might think that we will. So, for example, you know, we're seeing, if you're in the space where you're doing a lot of things online, you might see that a lot of software costs are rising rapidly. Now, that's something that might have come as a surprise, but actually for your profit to work now and in the future, you've got to always be uplisting for the fact that, you know, your supply costs are going to go up. Your platform fees for software companies that you rely on and you need to reduce will go up. That's not a bad thing. That's life. That is, you know, inflation, and it's the improvements that are going through them sometimes. We have to factor that in. If you are, you know, dealing with raw materials and parts, those will go up as well. So if you're maybe dealing with, you know, fuel increases, that could hit your fleet, you know, next week, potentially, if you haven't got really good buying power and maybe you're buying in advance, agreeing prices, things like that.
Okay, so listen, knowing that your customers, I know that you love working with mission-driven founders, as the Yanks might call them. Let's say people who have got are on a mission, they want to make a dent in the world. That's the reason they're in business in the first place. Sounds like, on balance, this book's still pretty good for them to read. Or would you say, is there another book that you would say? Because I would imagine if you have people who are very passionate, either they're making a rocket ship, they're an Elon Musk, they're building something huge, or they are not grounded in the finances and unfortunately are doomed to fail. So who is this, the book, the right fit for, and who should maybe ignore it?
I think it's one thing actually that I've seen a feedback on, which is people don't understand the book, is people saying profits first, that means putting people second, because if you're focusing on profits, you're not focusing on the bigger picture. And actually that's not a nice tactic. Whereas I disagree with that. I think actually maybe it's a wider public education piece on the part of mission-driven businesses, but actually when you make profit and you're a good business and you've got good ethics through your company, that's only going to be a good thing, because you can sustain yourself. You can pay people good wages. You can use ethical suppliers. So I think actually, in many ways, I wouldn't say it's not suitable for people. I would say it does apply still to people that maybe are skeptical of profits and want to get more comfortable with the idea of being profitable, which sounds funny, but there's some really great people that are doing really cool things that are going, actually, should we be making all this money out of it? Is it right that we're making good money out of this amazing technical innovation we've come up with? And the answer is probably yes, because if you're earning good money, the power you've got is in how you spend that money and how you look after the people in your workforce and yourselves and innovate and do the good stuff. So I would say actually have it as your starting point. But the message I would say around it is, don't think that you sorted your profit by creating bank accounts and putting the money into them. The book's quite big. There's lots to it. There's people that are practitioners in it, and there's probably a lot more to it. But the thing that people seem to take away is just, it's the bank structure and everything will flow. I would say just take that as the first step, and then maybe be open to the fact that there's something else you might need to do. And actually, that's not a bad thing. It doesn't mean you failed if your pots aren't filling up with money. It just means that that's only half of the story, and there is more to it than that.
Okay, so Harriet, I understand you have room for a client, a new client. So what would be the chef's kiss perfect person for you to work with next?
So I would say actually, if this has resonated that you are puzzling over your profit, this is something I like to get stuck into. I find it really interesting to look at all the pieces and, you know, to see that transformation of going, we've got something that if we carry on like this, we just can't keep it running, to turning that around to say, do you know what, we can actually do this if we take a fresh look at what's going on and make some empowered decisions. So if this has resonated, you know, I'd be up for a conversation. yeah, so I think the place where I can add most value is where, you know, you are quite ideas driven. You're probably, you know, you founded the company on the basis of creating some social change, or you've seen a problem in the world and you're trying to fix it through your business. And actually, that's what I can really get behind, because I will be so committed to helping you solve this, make the money, make it work, if I know that, you know, what you're doing is really positive. When you serve more customers, scale, move into other countries, do all the good stuff, actually, it's for a really good mission that we can all be proud to be associated with. So I'd say that's something that's important.
Great. I love your energy, Harriet. You've obviously got a passion for what you do, and it's great to see that. So we'll roll on here to my final question of the podcast, which is, who's your business hero and why?
This is one that I did have a think about, and I thought about some, you know, maybe generic answers of people that are very big business leaders, etc. But what I wanted to share is something that has been quite inspirational for my journey recently, because it's very much about the emotional side of finance, which, you know, as business owners, we are human as well as being business owners and very professional. And I wanted to just, yeah, mention Chantel Chapman, who runs a program and a whole business in Canada, Trauma of Money. And it's actually a whole approach to money, a bit like, I suppose, a system that, you know, profits first is a system. This is a different model of looking at money. And it's something that, you know, I might have come here and talked about what I found tricky with profits first, but I, you know, very much I'm someone very curious about different ideas, different ways of looking at things.
And is this finance, like a budgeting system or a worldview or a cult or what is it? It's
stems from personal finances is where it begins, but it applies to business. It's basically taking it from the blame side of you're not good with money because you're flawed in some way. So as business owners, we might be saying, because we don't understand it, because we're not disciplined, because we don't have a system, or we're not, you know, careful enough. It's the flipping the script to say, actually, you're not good with money is not true. You are actually good with money. The problem is you're operating in quite a difficult situation. You might not have the education. You might not. There might be influences in, you know, your nervous system that are meaning things are difficult because of past experience around money and other traumas. And actually, this is really key, because if you're somebody that is continuously seeing that the cash flow is drained and you're precariously, you know, running things, but otherwise you're a brilliant person and there's no reason why your business should be failing, it's basically taking a look at things from a different perspective and acknowledging that emotional part of money. It's something that I've been working to kind of integrate, because I was often seeing business owners, you know, having lots of, you know, similar situations to here. You've got the money in the bank, but suddenly they spent it all, or they're worried to spend it and they're scared of the profit side of things or earning good money. And it's very much, yeah, acknowledging that actually, and, you know, when you've got things like you can't pay the tax bill, it creates a lot of stress. And, you know, if you're looking for funding and all that sort of thing, if in the startup end of things, actually, we do need to look after the emotional side to get the full picture, really. So very much the strategies, the good sense, the good, you know, logical finance brain stuff, I think very much fits with the emotional side to things as well.
Great. Okay. So thanks, Harriet. So I'll let you into a secret. And thank you for listening this far, listener, if you got this far in. I'll let you into a little secret. My business partner, Richard, has been asking, what are you doing on this podcast? Why are we doing it? What's it doing for Procurement Express? So what I've done is, this morning, hot off the presses, I've taken all of the advice I've taken from all the fractional CFOs I've interviewed with, and I put it into a webinar and combined it with our partnership program at Procurement Express. So if you are listening to this and you are a fractional CFO, or you work on a finance team, and you're looking for smart ways to make impact with clients quickly to demonstrate your value, because demonstrating the value of the finance team, there's never been a bigger disconnect between the ability for someone to impact a business and the understanding of how that works in my experience. You can understand if you hire a sales guy, he's going to get you more sales. You can understand if you get operations people, they're going to do the work. Finance people is a little bit more nuanced, and getting that value across, I found, is something that finance professionals sometimes struggle with. So in this webinar, I've tried to explain by giving a case study. Ben de la Cretas, he's one of our partners. He does a really good job of explaining value that fractional CFOs can bring. And I put it together in a webinar. You can get it at procurementexpress.com/webinar. So your reward for listening this far into the podcast is getting access to this. And I'd love you to sign up there. So thanks for listening. And Harriet, thanks for coming along today. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for having me.